My name is John Marty, and for those of you who, for some background, I'm a state senator in Minnesota, and this topic may be in some ways appropriate for today. Rob Wall had his talk about chapters 4 and 5 of James, the part where James talks about wealth and poverty this morning, or wealth more than poverty in James, and this noon during the solidary meal in which we had a talk about poverty as well. What do I mean by the politics of wealth and poverty? Well, I'd like to make the premise that American government and in various states, that our government is far more understanding and more sympathetic of the needs and interests of people who have a great deal of wealth than they do of people who have much less wealth, including the poor. And I would suggest that that tilt of government is far more than the public would be aware of and far more than the public would support. And it's hard to say where the public is on these things, but I would make the presumption at least that government does far more than the public is aware of to help people with high incomes and much far less to help those of the low incomes. And I think that's contra-intuitive to what most people have heard in the past. We know that our dollars go to help people on welfare, and we're not as aware of the dollars that are going to people with the high income and stuff. Clarification? Right. Today I'm talking. Right. I'm talking about individuals here, though, for instance, corporate ownership in America is, there are people who are very modest income who own part of corporations, either small family businesses or they own stock in large corporations. They own very, very, very small amounts of stock compared to somebody who is high income. But what I'm talking about here, just for clarification, is that we're talking about individuals, and that government as a whole in this country, my premise is far more sympathetic and understanding of the needs of the wealthy than the poor, or for that matter, the middle. Economic disparities are growing in the country. 30 years ago, the wages, we're talking wages and salaries, not unearned income, dividends, money you get from your investments. But the actual wages and salaries of the top 4% 30 years ago equaled the total wages and salaries of the bottom 35%. Now it's equal to more than the bottom half. So the total wealth of the bottom, total income from salaries and wages of the bottom 50% is less than the top 4% salaries and wages, if you factor in investment income as well and other things such as benefits, healthcare benefits and other things, it tends to be much greater disparity than that. But there is, and there has been in the last 15, 20 years, a growing disparity there. And whether that's a good thing or bad thing, I would argue that's a bad thing, but regardless of what one thinks of whether that's the way it should be or not, there has been this growth in disparity. We've done this through a number of ways. Government has shown sympathy towards this in recent years. Tax cuts, 1981 and in 86, the tax reform gave significantly more tax relief to people at the top end, and significantly less relief, though, in 81 tax cut, everybody got a tax cut. The trouble was, by taking away the money from government, other things end up paying the bills more. Interest rates for somebody who's borrowing for a home went up because government's been borrowing more money and competing for it more. As states and local governments have been forced to pick up the tabs for things the federal government used to pick up the tabs for, they use less progressive taxes. Tax progressivity, meaning if a progressive tax is one which you base it on ability to pay, you are going to tax more to people who can afford to pay more, less to people who can afford to pay less. Income tax is seen as a progressive tax. Property taxes, sales taxes, fees, generally excise taxes, all other sorts of taxes tend to be harder hitting as a percentage of income on somebody who is at the bottom end than somebody who's at the top end. But how has government, what has government done that's done this? Tax cuts on high income people. Our government feels in 1981 the tax cut on high income people was designed to provide incentives to high income people. They would generate more wealth by building the economy would pick up. So by cutting taxes for the wealthy, we were going to generate more money for government. I've always questioned that fairness when we say that people at the bottom end don't seem to need any incentives in our eyes. We have a system where somebody who's in poverty, who's on welfare, if they're going to get a job, we take away their money almost dollar for dollar. In some cases, you take away more than dollar for dollar because they have to pay for childcare, they lose their health care benefits and other things. So at the same time we complain about the poor being lazy and needing incentives, we say by cutting taxes on the wealthy, they will invest more in the economy. I don't think in practice that somebody who's making $200,000 a year, if that's a 50 weeks of work a year at 40 hours a week, that comes out to a nice round $100 an hour. Somebody who's making $200,000 a year, giving them a tax break because that'll give them more incentive to do it, I think you can question how much more incentive it gives them. You could make the counter argument that, well, if we get more money for the same amount of work, why should we work as hard? But there is some incentive there already. $100 an hour is significant incentive for most people. But our government has chosen, made a conscious decision, we're going to cut taxes on highest income people because it will provide more incentives. As a part of this favoring my premise that American government is more sympathetic to the needs of well-off people, we've gotten rid of several other concepts that I think the public at large supports, and we treat them as radical concepts, one of which is the concept of a living wage, somebody working full-time being able to support themselves. I don't think that's a radical idea. I don't think it's something we should be opposed to. I think it's something we as a country really ought to have. And there are a couple ways you can do it. You can have a higher minimum wage, and you can provide tax policies that are going to help that way. An earned income tax credit the federal government has for low-income working families. If you earn below a certain amount in wages and salaries, you get a tax credit. Through tax credits and minimum wages, we could assure that somebody who's working full-time can support themselves. We think that's radical. If we were to raise the minimum wage by more than a quarter an hour, people would say, oh, we can't compete. We're going to lose business to overseas. We're going to go out of business, something else of that sort. It is always struck me as kind of contradictory that the same businesses that say if we have to pay our workers more, we can't compete, but they also say if we can't pay our CEOs these higher salaries, we can't compete in drawing good people. And it strikes me as the same policy ought to apply to both ends. If you can't get good people by one way, you're not going to get good people at the other end without the money. The concept of providing universal health care, I think it's something most American citizens think people ought to have a right to health care. I happen to think people ought to have a right to health care. The concept of all kids in our country having enough food or decent shelters or a decent educational opportunity. Maybe not that everyone's going to have the chance to become a nuclear physicist, but that everyone can get the basic educational opportunity that they need in order to succeed in the adult world. And that doesn't just mean, well, we're going to, here's this school, you get to the school and we'll take care of you for 7 hours a day, 6 hours a day, and therefore you're going to, that was your opportunity. If somebody goes to school hungry or they're homeless and they move five times in the school year, we're not really giving them a fair chance, a fair educational opportunity. So educational opportunity means more than just sitting somebody in a classroom with a competent teacher in front of them. We've actually created a situation that in my mind, despite the fact government has done much in its policies that favor high incomes over low income people in meeting their needs or their desires or whatever, that we have a situation in which the public at large including middle class, including a lot of low-income people, actually do not resent the special privileges and tax breaks that the wealthy get. They far more resent the special privileges and benefits that the poor get. We don't think about the high-income things that people get, beneficiaries from government giving of various forms, but we do resent and we understand the welfare chiseler, the lazy bum. And so even people who are very close to poverty they're the ones who are resenting others who are in very similar shape. They may not see a subsidy they get in one way as a subsidy, but they see somebody else. The food stamps is probably one of the biggest ones. They resent the person who cheats on food stamps or something of that sort. And we all hear about, I think we've all heard about, we talked about defense contractor scandals the other night. We talk about, there's been a lot of stuff about the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the HUD scandal in recent years, and some people may actually serve time for it, the SNL scandal. Just wanted to take 1 minute, or make that a couple of minutes, to read. Yes?
You're running by concepts like the whirlwind.
Okay. Okay. Go ahead. Okay. Sure.
The notion of the middle class taking issue with the poor side and not the rich side, there's at least two factors there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The first is that that 4% we talked about, at least half of that high income component is earned by people and industries in direct support of the things that the lower half of the income group are interested in. When you talk about $20 million for
mm-hmm.
They don't want to see that rainbow snuffed up.
Right.
Now, you might react to both.
Okay. I actually was going to talk about the second one of those later in explaining why I think society, the public at large, thinks and is more upset at the fact that government helps people of low income than the fact that they help people at high income levels. On the first one, I would take issue with the fact that at least half of the top 4% are athletes and entertainers and so on. I would care to venture a guess that we're talking more like 0.1%. But nevertheless, whatever, the fact that I may enjoy going to baseball games and some of my favorite baseball players may be paid multi-million dollar salaries, that is a choice that our economic system sets up. And that's different. It's not different in terms of how government treats them, but it is different in terms of I had some choice in the fact that they're getting that much pay. But nevertheless, I don't think... What?
Yes,
that's correct. You chose to give them. That's one of the few cases where I have some say as a purchaser of a ticket how much somebody's going to get paid, because that's purely... That's a very clear one, because there isn't that much overhead. I mean, there's the salaries of the players, there's the cost of the stadium, and there are certain other things. And my ticket price, a significant portion of that's going to it. When I choose to buy a pair of shoes or a shirt or something, the fact that the CEO of the store is making twice as much as the CEO of another store, I really don't have much say in that. I'm not going to know what they are. The entertainment one is different. But I'll get back to the other one a little bit more later. On the SNL scandal, I'd like to take a couple of minutes to read, talking about, this was from the Philadelphia Inquirer, that the book a couple of years ago, America, What Went Wrong, and it's talking about, just to give us a better sense, because most of us aren't familiar with the types of ways that government treats high-income people in recent years. Meet Thomas Spiegel. He's the former chairman and CEO of Columbia Savings and Loan Association, a Beverly Hills-based thrift that the New York Times described in February 89 as an institution that, quote, has been extremely successful investing in junk bonds and other ventures, close quote. Spiegel is a major fundraiser and financial supporter of political candidates, Democrats and Republicans alike. He and his family live in a six-bedroom Beverly Hills home complete with swimming pool, tennis court, and entertainment pavilion that could be purchased for about $10 million. Spiegel thrived at Columbia during the 1980s, a time when executive branch of the federal government loosened regulatory oversight of the savings and loan industry. Working with his friend and business associate Michael Milken, whose Drexel Burnham Lambert Incorporated office was just down the street in Beverly Hills, Spiegel used depositors' federally insured savings to buy a portfolio of junk bonds, the high-risk debt instruments that promised to pay big dividends. Columbia's profits soared. Earnings jumped from $44 million in 84 to $122 million in 85 and $193 million in 86 before trailing off to $119 million in 87 and $85 million in 88. Spiegel's compensation for those years averaged slightly under $100,000 a week. He spent $2,000 for French wine tasting course, $3,000 a night for hotel suites on the French Riviera, $20,000 for cashmere throws and comforters, $8,600 for towels, and $91,000 for a collection of guns. Not unusual outlays, you might think, for someone who collected a multi-million-dollar yearly salary. Only in this case, according to a much-belated federal audit, it was Columbia, the savings and loan, not Spiegel, that picked up the tab. There is, to be sure, nothing new about lavish corporate expense accounts. The practice of converting personal living expenses to a deduction on a company or business tax return has been around as long as the income tax. It's a practice Congress has been unable to curb. But in the 1980s, corporate tax write-offs for personal executive expenses, as well as overall corporate excesses, from gold-plated plumbing fixtures in the private office to family wedding receptions in Paris and London, reached epidemic proportions. The reasons varied among them. The pace of corporate restructuring brought on by Wall Street created a climate in which once unacceptable practices became acceptable, indeed were even chronicled on radio and television, newspapers, and magazines. In a monumental change in the rules, Congress deregulated the savings and loan industry, in effect opening the doors to the vaults of the nation's savings institutions, but at the same time discouraging meaningful audits or crackdowns where irregularities were detected. The Internal Revenue Service lacks the staffing and time to conduct the intense audits of companies that would uncover such abuses, and even if the resources were available, an impenetrable tax code places too many other demands on the agency. All this made possible a Tom Spiegel and an army of other corporate executives who lived high on their expense accounts. Federal auditors eventually found Spiegel used Columbia funds to pay for trips to Europe, to buy luxury condos in Columbia's name in the U.S., to purchase expensive aircraft. From 87 to 89, for example, Spiegel made at least four trips to Europe at Columbia's expense, the auditors reported, staying at the best hotels, running up large tabs. They included $74.46 for hotel and room service for three nights in the Berkeley Hotel in London for Spiegel and his wife, $6,000 for hotel and room service for three nights in Hotel Plaza Athenee in Paris in July 89. The most expensive stay was July 89 at the Hotel du Cap on the French Riviera. A family ran up $16,500 in 5 days. To make all this travel easier, he arranged for Columbia a savings loan that had no offices outside of California to buy a corporate aircraft, including a Gulfstream IV equipped with kitchen and lounge. The federal auditors now say Columbia paid $2.4 million for use of corporate aircraft in commercial flights for the personal travel of Spiegel, his immediate family, and other persons accompanying him. Columbia wrote off those expenses on its tax returns, thereby transferring the cost of Spiegel's lifestyle to you, the taxpayer. He's contesting the fact that this was misused. But you're paying for more than his lifestyle. You're also going to be picking up the tab for his management at Columbia. After heading earnings in the 1980s, Columbia lost almost twice as much money in 89 and 90, a total of $1.4 billion as it had made in the previous 20 years added together. They seized Columbia in January 1991. Taxpayers will pay a bailout expected to cost more than $1.5 billion. Talks about more about the kinds of things that he was spending on in building this new corporate headquarters for Columbia. That's one of many types of things. It's a little bit complex to understand why changes in our laws at the federal level has allowed more of these things to happen. Not all those things were legit. He's under investigation for some of them. Michael Milken has served time. A whole lot of people actually have been punished for doing these things. But in terms of where government spends its money cracking down on fraud and abuse, the amount we spend trying to stop welfare fraud when somebody uses food stamps to buy cigarettes or beer, or more likely misreports, fails to report income, $200 or $300 a month that they got, and gets more welfare benefits because of that. I think the public spends more time resenting and criticizing those practices than they do the high income stuff, because we never quite see it, and we almost have to be in awe at the fact that somebody lives this this high up. And and clearly shows like lifestyles of the rich and famous, as he mentioned, we all dream somehow, whether by winning lottery tickets or somehow or another, maybe we're going to be there someday. We don't identify with the poor, even if we're nearly poor ourselves. We identify with where we want to be. It may not be realistic, but we think we might be there. So we spend our time resenting the fact that high income people, we don't resent that. We spend our time resenting the other stuff instead. Yes?
I'm more resentful of the government.
Right.
What the devil is going on?
Yes, sir.
The proportion of money that we're talking about, which is
gold, it's a good question. And that's one of my.
Yeah.
See, one of them. No, I wouldn't argue that it's. There are a couple of reasons for it. One of which is. No. My criticism is not of people for being wealthy. My point is, the whole premise was that American government is far more sympathetic to people with high incomes than people with low incomes. One of the ways they do that is they step in and do what people want them to. People with high incomes want them to. They liked the deregulation of the SNL. They liked less active, lower tax rates. Why do they do these things? Why do they slacken off in this? The one big scandal involving money and political money in the federal government in recent years, the Keating Five scandal, that was a well-off individual who was spending money on public officials trying to get their intervention in the process. So that's, I'm not disagreeing with you that what people should be angry at is that. That's what I'm saying they should be angry at, the way government has tilted the system away from what the concerns of most of America should be, and giving its sympathy and best treatment to the people who need it the least, and in a way that allows everybody else to be taken. And in that, the people who regulate these industries, I don't think most members of Congress really objected to regulation of the SNL industry. They were responding to pressure. When people, I mean, Keating had a lot of nerve. I mean, his thing was failing because of bad investments. And the federal government was trying to step in, regulators were trying to step in, and he started trying to influence the political process to do it. And when I get to why I think this is the case, that's one of the reasons. First of all, I'd like to argue why it's bad what's happening, if this case study I gave and so on isn't seen as bad. For one thing, it's bankrupting the country. The deficit we face every year, not the debt, but the deficit we face is about $1,000, more than $1,000 per citizen, government spending more than $1,000 per person per year, more than it takes in. And if you factor in, if you figure out what the national debt is, it's closer to $20,000 each one of us would have to pay off the national debt. At the same time we're bankrupting the country, we are allowing some very unfortunate things. Last there was a story about a Minnesota kid who lost his hearing because the parents couldn't afford the medical attention when the child had an ear infection. They weren't sure he had an infection, they couldn't afford to, we'll take care of it in a week or two, and the kid lost his hearing as a result. This noon, if people were there at the solidarity meal, the woman who made the presentation talked about how the apples we eat here, picked right near here, the migrant workers who pick the apples earn she said, in a good year, $7,000, less than enough to pay to put that apple on their own table. It seems to me that in a decent country, we want to make it sure that people who pick apples can at least afford to give their family apples. We'll get to the questions, okay? If you have questions of clarifications, that's one thing. We'll have discussion. I'll leave plenty of time for discussion. We've got more than half an hour left. What I'm saying is, you can make those points then. I want to make the points first of all, and we'll discuss it then. If you have a point of clarification, I'm happy to interrupt for that. We also have in Minnesota, I know, and I think it's true in most other states, we have drug addicts who want to address, who we've gotten to the point where they want to address their addiction, but they can't. Minnesota now has, we have a waiting list to get on that, and the waiting list has been cut off because it's full. So you can't even, you got to wait to get on the waiting list to get treatment because you've got a problem you want help with. Not only is that inhumane in my mind, but it also means we have more drug addicts running around than we otherwise would need to. And certainly giving treatment to everyone who wants treatment isn't going to solve our drug problems, but it would help. It would take away some of the people who have drug addiction. In terms of bankrupting the country, the interest on the federal debt in 1990 had reached $184 billion, contrasted with the total amount we spend through K-12 education in the country of $199 billion. We're spending almost as much on interest payments as we pay for education for kids. The teacher was asking me a little while ago before I came in here, what are we going to do about funding schools? We need more money in the schools, and nowhere in the country is there the money we have to do it. Well, we're continuing to pay higher and higher amounts for interest on the federal debt. It's been an ongoing payment since the beginning of the country, but it's now getting to the point where we're spending such a large portion of our income as a nation on interest that we can't afford to pay other things because of it. Why does the system favor the wealthy? I'd like to make several claims. First of all, politicians, like all of us, somewhat identify with the upper class, politicians much more so. First of all, many are personally wealthy. I mean, there were, until Senator Heintz died in a plane crash a year or two ago, there were two hundreds of millions in the U.S. Senate, and several more who have at least tens of millions in personal family wealth. And I think the number I've seen is somewhere around 25 to 40 members of the U.S. Senate are millionaires. Millionaires doesn't mean a fraction of what it used to mean, but a whole percentage of them are very well off personally. Either they came from big money or they were very successful in business or whatever. They tend to be wealthy themselves. Second of all, their incomes now are in the top 3%. They're at $125,000-$130,000 a year for the U.S. Congress. That's maybe expensive, and they may have two homes. That may be a lot of money, and they have two homes, and they have all kinds of other expenses. But nevertheless, their income is in the top 3% of the national per capita income. They are doing very well that way, and they are surrounded by people who are, if they are themselves not well off, they're surrounded by people who make much more than them. People of power, people of influence, and often people who have wealth. At our state capitol, I think the average lobbyist, it's not disclosed, but from the salaries I've seen from the public sector payments to private sector lobbyists, when the city wants to hire a private lobbyist, what I see in terms of the contracts, I will guess that the average lobbyist at our state capitol gets about four times as much as the state legislator does. And when you look at the salaries of certain former government executives who lobby at the federal level, you know there are a lot of people well into six digits who are lobbying members of Congress and who spend a lot of time around them. So they're surrounded by people with a lot of money. They themselves have a lot of money. And that's one of the reasons. So they tend to identify themselves with upper income people. And again, I'm not trying to define here what upper income is or what wealthy people are. I'm using the term wealthy loosely. People who earn $200,000 a year think of themselves as middle class. People very near the bottom think of themselves as middle class too, and we can debate that. But I'm talking in terms of by percentage of the population, top 3, 4, 5%, people who tend to have 100,000 plus a year in income. So that's one of the factors, is that politicians themselves tend to identify with it. The second one is who has access to the political process. The poor don't have lobbyists. Church groups sometimes step in and fill that role, but basically hire somebody or you get somebody to volunteer to represent your interests so you can work together to make a difference. There's nothing wrong with that, but frankly, if we rely on lobbyists to provide information, which at every level of government we do, the poor don't have the lobbyists. People with higher incomes and their interests tend to have much better lobbying access. And related to that is special interest money on the political process, which I think is one of the biggest scandals in American government, not because people are crooked for putting money into the process or because politicians accept it, either for campaigns, campaign contributions, or personal gifts or favors, but nevertheless, it has an impact on the political process. If somebody gives me $1,000, somebody I've never met before, I'm going to be more favorably inclined to listen to their concerns. I don't have to be crooked and take their $1,000 and give them a vote on some issue in order to suggest there's a problem. It's human nature. If I give you $1,000, you're going to think I'm a nicer person than if I don't. And we just tend to respond more favorably to people who are nice to us, and one of the nicest ways to be nice to somebody is through financing, giving money to their campaigns, giving gifts or favors to them, whether it's the trip, all expense paid trip to some conference in the Bahamas where they're expected to show up at a half hour meeting and they have a 3-day all expenses paid trip with their families. That kind of thing is clearly something that's done not because these interest groups don't know what to do with their money, but because they know it has an impact. Likewise with campaign contributions, some would argue, oh, they give money to people who they agree with because they really want them to get elected. That's part of it, but that does suggest people with a lot of money have more ability to help get their friends elected. But also, that doesn't account for everything. A lot of interest groups, a lot of individuals give money to both sides in a race. First time I was elected in '86, I wasn't supposed to win, and shortly after I won, I got a nice letter from a lobbyist who enclosed a contribution. Enclosed is a contribution from one of my clients who had the misfortune of having contributed to your opponent. Here's $400 as they wish to make amends. Why were they giving, why did they give him the money? Was it because they thought he would be the best state senator to represent the state of Minnesota from that community? I doubt it. Was it even that they thought he was more sympathetic to their concerns than I was? I doubt it. Did they change their mind because all of a sudden they had some great awakening as to who was really more interested in their concerns? No, it had nothing to do with it. I won. I was the one who was going to be voting on it, on their issues. He couldn't. He was far gone as far as they were concerned, so now they wanted to be nice to me. They do give money, not because they don't have anything better to do with it, but because they know it gets more access in the political process. So certainly special interest money is another reason that government tends to favor interests of people with higher incomes rather than lower incomes. Another one is simply the time and influence. Poor, in many cases, are not able to vote. Migrant workers, we've talked about earlier, they may often move around too much to be able to be in a place to vote. Until civil rights movement, blacks were not allowed to vote. I mean, we can say, oh yes, they were allowed to vote, but practically speaking, they had no opportunity to register. And the violence of the Selma incidents, all of that was related simply to voting rights. A lot of the violence in Mississippi in the mid-60s was also related to the fact that people wanted the right to vote. if people don't have the right to vote, the poor, the disenfranchised, that way they have less eyes an elected official looking about where I'm going to get my votes for the next election, which some people frankly do spend time at least subconsciously thinking about. Those people, they don't participate, who cares? And related to that, they don't have the political clout, they don't have the ability to help or hurt a candidate. And even those who can vote, which most Americans we would realistically say can vote these days, but a person struggling to survive and struggling to get enough income to take care of themselves, a single parent with a couple of kids, is going to be less likely to take the time to vote when they don't have the whatever. Did you have?
Could you comment along that line, the sides that were taken in legislation that was proposed on like motor voter bills?
Okay. Yeah, that's the kind of thing. That's been intended, motor voter types of things, to make it easier. In general, the more easier you make access to the political process, the better. If you have to go in person to some office and register at least 2 months before an election, first of all, you disenfranchise a lot of people who move frequently. And second of all, somebody who can just barely find a few minutes to vote, the more difficult you make it for them, you make two trips out of the house for them and so on, the more less likely they are to participate. In the concept of motor voter, if somebody is going to get a driver's license, anything like that, you include a voter registration form with it and they can take care of it at the same time. It still is an extra hurdle they have to go through, but it's 2 minutes of their time while that's handed to them, rather than the concept of them having to think, oh, where do I find the phone number to call for voter registration information? So that's clearly related to that subject. And finally, why else is government more sympathetic to this? I referred to it a little bit earlier. The public pressure tends to be bashing the poor, even among the poor themselves. The civil rights days, it wasn't well-educated whites in the South as much who were the KKK members and so on. It tended to be poor whites. We're going to lose our jobs. I saw a Jesse Helms commercial that was quite heavily publicized a few years ago, a guy wearing a plaid, red and black plaid shirt, crumpling up a letter that they say, you were rejected for the job, you were the most qualified, but they gave it to somebody else because he was a minority. Something like that. We're taking away your jobs to give them to them. We're taking your taxes, which you can hardly afford to pay now, to give it to this lazy bum on welfare. You pit one group against the other, and the public, for whatever reason, has found out. I get 1,000 times more complaints in constituent mail and phone calls about welfare cheats than I do about people who cheat on high-income people or others who cheat on their income taxes or who scandalous things that people do that cheat the government at the high end of things. And that's partly perhaps a lack of clear understanding of complex ways that government tilts one way than the other, and it may be partly human nature and partly the fact that people do tend to identify with the rich, as you mentioned, whether it's because of lottery or because we think somehow or another we're going to move up the structure and we're going to someday or another we're going to just, our new invention, our business, our whatever is going to put us in that category and we want to enjoy our money once we finally get there. What are the prospects for change? Things don't ever get too far out of line or too much further than they are now when heavier and heavier percentage of the population starts losing its health care. At some point, government is forced by political pressure, perhaps a populist pressure. The early 1900s, there was a lot of that. Whenever there's a heavy populist pressure, it pushes government the other way, and then things tend to slip that way. So I think it's not going to continue in a cycle in which we're going to continue and continue for another 20 years to have a very small upper class that's very well off and middle class continuing to shrink and more people becoming poor. I think that it will change just because the political pressures at some point build up the other way. Healthcare may be one of those examples of that happening now. the medical association, the hospital association, every insurance, health insurance company a few years ago, strongly anti-healthcare reform. I think more and more of them are recognizing there's going to be healthcare reform. Let's try and influence it the way we want it to be. We're not going to try and change it. Why? Because I don't know many families that don't know somebody in their family, a kid just out of college, or parents whose company cut back on benefits, who are having trouble paying for their health care. Everybody, almost everybody, knows somebody who's really struggling with it and sees it getting worse and premiums getting worse, and they recognize that. And therefore, at a certain point, the political clout from the populist force of the public at large feeling the pressure overwhelms the status quo, and there happens to be change. So with that, I'd like to stop it and now open it up for the discussion, and hope that's some good food for thought. Yes?
Just one item of clarification. You said earlier in your speech that 4%, top 4% at one time had income equal to the bottom
35, yeah.
And recently it's the bottom 50%. What kind of money is like 4%?
Who makes it? Yeah.
Bottom to top 4%.
I haven't seen numbers nationally on what it is, but I think they're pretty close to this. Minnesota, it's top 4% is taxable income. And this is joint family income by taxpayer stuff. It's income slightly over $100,000 taxable for a married joint filer in Minnesota is about where the top 4% kicks in. The top 1%, and this was a number that kind of blew me away, but the top 1% starts in Minnesota at about $275,000 a year, and the average of that top 1% is over $750,000 a year, which suggests very small number with very high incomes, that the top, that the bottom of it starts at 270 some thousand, but the average is three times that high. Those are Minnesota numbers. I don't know. I'm assuming they're pretty similar for the rest of the country. Minnesota might have a slightly higher than average, but I think our average income is pretty, our average income is pretty similar to the national average. Whether the disparity between high and low income is similar, I'm not sure. Yes?
Would you say the 4% level?
It's over 100,000 in taxable income, not much over. It's 110 or so, but 105. But I think that realistically works out to, in most cases, real income is being more like 125, 130,000. It depends on, widely varies depending on how many deductions somebody has, of course. Yeah, I mean, those, right, the higher your tax bracket, the more you search out tax-free investments. When I was talking, those numbers, the ones I just gave you, were for income, taxable income. That was not wages and salaries. This 4% as opposed to 51%, it's not apples and oranges, because this was wages and salaries. I don't have a number for what wages and salaries are in terms of what the top 4% of that is. I also think that's a less useful number than total income, because for certain people, wages and salaries are a small fraction of what they get. For others, it's the only thing they get. So realistically, I think all income ought to be figured, when we're trying to estimate these things, all income ought to be figured alike, and I'm sorry I don't have that number for that.
But what you're saying is, it's the top 4% taxable income versus the bottom 50% taxable income.
The number I gave here, that 4% versus that 51%, that was wages and salaries, which is not all taxable. It's all taxable income, but that's not all there is. I mean, taxable income includes all your deductions and so on. So we're talking right there. That's 4% for wages and salaries that the top 4% make equal that. And I don't know what those dollar numbers are. I just know that the wage and salary breakdown is there. It would be a 4% would probably be more like 60%. That's just a guess if you figured in terms of unearned income as well. But I don't have that, and I'm not trying to, I don't try and play games with statistics to try and make them look more to prove my point. I just don't have those numbers, and it's something that some of these numbers are hard to get. It is hard to estimate what somebody in what a top percent has in certain things. Taxable income is an easy one to calculate because every state collects it. Yes?
During the SNL scandal, quote, I was talking to a brother-in-law of mine who said that he tried to get into the, to get part of the savings and loan charter in California because he said it was a license to steal. And a rather well-known fact,
it's one of the most, in terms of scandals over the past 20 years, in terms of what it costs each one of us, it's got to be the biggest one, by far and away the biggest, most expensive thing we face. Banks, some banks are in crisis these days too.
Doesn't that sound strange? We, the people, are taking on the financial burden for what government screwed up.
True.
Government had a bunch of crooks in it and they let this stuff go. There are many states that didn't have these kind of problems. There's a few states. But I see, that's the thing that I was looking at.
Mm-hmm.
That's what interests me. Government screwed up. We gotta pay for it.
It's our government. We do have to pay for it. Yeah, yeah. That's right.
What is the purpose of the government?
The purpose of the government. That's why the whole purpose of this. Right, sir. I'm perfectly familiar with it. The point of this. I'm not disagreeing with you. Yes, you want to argue with me, and I don't mind if you want to argue. But I'm trying to say I don't disagree. It's our government. And we end up picking up the tab when something goes wrong, and government botched it. Some corruption, yes, there's been some corruption in government, some laziness, a whole range of things. There are a whole lot of factors that accounted for it. I tried to explain some of why it's been that way. But yes, government screwed up, and I don't disagree, and I think that it's a shame, but realistically, we all end up paying for it. That's my point. That's why I'm saying you seem to want to say I'm disagreeing with that, but I'm not. That's the whole point. The point is when government messes up, we have to pay for it, and therefore we ought to be a little more mindful of what government is doing, and government itself has a responsibility to do that, which it has fallen down on the job on. And we don't have an SNL, we don't regulate SNLs as a state. A lot of those things are federal government problems. Every state has its own problems as well. But the dollars amounts are too great here. That's why I spent a lot of time on the whole special interest money issue, both in campaign contributions and other things, the gifts and favors type of thing, because it has such a big impact. The dollar amounts we're talking about are astronomical and they affect every one of us so much. A slight tilt, not a payoff, not a bribe, but even a subconscious tilt in your mind in favor of something because somebody did something for you is so much of an impact. I'll take a couple over here, then over there. Yes, go ahead.
Some of the seminars I've attended in other places, I've come to an understanding that part of the shift of the disparity in income from 4% to the 33% to down to 50% is because of the shift in how our economy was made. We're no longer an industrial-based economy, we're in a service-based economy. It's not unemployment, it's non-employment.
Mm-hmm.
It's very similar back in the early 1900s when we shifted from agriculture into an industrial society where you didn't need 12 children on the farm
anymore.
Right. run a farm, so they were displaced in the cities, and then climate change. Now in industry, you don't need the same number of people, you just don't have those jobs. And so we're moving from jobs that were $20 to $15 an hour to more minimum wage, and that certainly would account for a greater number of people being in that more industry. Mm-hmm.
True.
Not so
right.
Much that
it's
all
wrapped, right. There's, it's a good point. Did everybody hear it? That that the whole reason for this greater disparity between rich and poor is not necessarily because of graft or corruption or I don't know if you said anything else, but it's not simply because of that. But it's changes in the economy. What I would like to say is true. That is very true. One of the causes of some of those changes is the way government relates to things. The fact that we write off corporate debt was not a big problem in the past, but in the last 20 years, the whole corporate buyout thing was encouraged by that. Minnesota's been fighting for the last couple of years with trying to, one time the state has helped out, and now Northwest Airlines owes us a lot of money, and we're hoping Northwest doesn't go belly up. What happened? Two guys bought out Northwest. Not with their money. They borrowed money to do it, and they write off the stuff. The tax policies have encouraged some of that. They've encouraged some of it moving jobs down by the takeover stuff has not necessarily made businesses more productive. This book is really worth taking the time to read, America, What Went Wrong. It's depressing. It's very depressing, but it's accurate. I mean, it talks a lot about how the move of jobs to Mexico. I mean, that's one of the reasons I have some concerns. It's not something I can do anything about. But the North American Free Trade Agreement won't change things radical in the sense that we're not having it happen now. But it will speed up the process of plants moving to Mexico. I don't think we as a country should be trying to compete with other countries in terms of dropping our salaries down to that point. That's against what I think is a basic concept of fairness. You work full time, you get enough money to live on. But we are slowly moving that way. We give people write-offs for borrowing money to build plants in Mexico so that we displace people here. And it's been speeded up very greatly by the corporate buyout thing, hostile takeovers and friendly takeovers. People borrow a lot of other people's money, deductible, so we subsidize that, in order to buy a bigger thing. Businesses don't grow by making more of whatever or by doing a better service. They do it by buying out their competitors. And that is, your observation is very true. Government has helped feed on that, and sometimes it may be unavoidable, it may not be undesirable in every case, but I would suggest that what's happened in the last 20 years has been very undesirable. People who had jobs paying them good, solid middle income wages have lost their jobs, and they come back and we can work at Burger King for $5.25 an hour and be proud we're not at minimum wage, no benefits. You're right, government does have an impact on that. I'll quickly take a few more questions over there, and.
Cause
Okay. Rather than trying to summarize it, did everybody hear it? She said it relatively well. Well, in the 150 years since he wrote that, we've survived as a democracy another 150 years, and so that alone would have added to it, it fed that his comments were right. If he was surprised we survived, we've still continued to, and I think we will continue to survive. In terms of self-interest, not everything we do is selfish and self-centered, and I want my taxes to go down, and who cares about everybody else? I think all of us have some selfish motives and some generous genes in us or whatever it is. We all have good and bad types of positive and negative types of attitudes in ourselves. And certainly, if you try and explain all of human behavior as a selfish motivation, which some have tried to do and so on, I don't think you can account for a whole lot of parts of human behavior. Why do people die in a war? Why do they volunteer to serve in a war? Because they're caring about their communities, their country. They care deeply about it, and they're not doing it for selfish reasons. Sometimes it's spiritual reasons, sometimes it's just a belief that our country has a lot going for it, and they've been a victim of an injustice, and we're going to fight that unjust force. Why did we get involved in World War II at all? Because we cared. We saw some terrible, unjust things happening. In the Pacific, we may not have had a choice, but in Europe, we did have some choice. It may have taken us more time, but there is some generous instincts in us, and so that's clearly part of it. And I don't, in talking about the examples I see of people who really are hurting in this country, or the fact that at the solidarity meal today, the woman was talking about migrant workers and how they suffer. She wasn't, she said she was a migrant worker, grew up in a migrant family. I'll bet most of the people in this room weren't or didn't come from that kind of impoverished background. I don't know that, some of you may have, but she could appeal to everybody in that hall. And I think she did a pretty good job of letting us, it tugs at us because we know there's something wrong and we care about that and we don't like to see those injustices. So I think we as a society do care about those things. I don't think of every rich person as being a greedy crook because they're not. There are lots of people who have been very successful, very good people who have been very successful. I think democracy can survive. I don't think we could survive strictly on economic self-interest. Adam Smith talked about the invisible hand of the market. There may be an invisible hand of the market, but that alone doesn't make up. If everybody is looking solely for their self-interest economically, I think things do fall apart, and government is one of the mediating factors that we're supposed to do, moderating factors to fill in the gaps. Why do we allow government to moderate that instead of letting all this run amok? Because we care and we want to have a decent society. I hope that somehow or another answers it. I'm not sure if that's what you're getting at. You, then you. Yes.
Sort of alluded to earlier that in the SNL scandal that we hold our politicians at fault regularly for that, but we continue to elect them again and again. We assume that it was the other guy, the legislator, that was at fault, not ours. Or we recognize that because of the longevity, the power that comes with longevity in the legislature, it's in our state's best self-interest to re-elect a senator or a congressman who holds powerful positions so that money can be...
pork barrel type of thing, yeah.
My question is, do you think term limitations could help reduce some of that?
Could it solve the problem? No. Could it help in some ways? It could help in some ways. I think it could also hurt in some ways. Because I think you've sort of stated, at least your question was suggesting why you think it would be a positive thing. Let me suggest some of the reasons I think it's a negative. One of which is, first of all, there are a whole lot of first-term elected officials who do a poor job, who are just as sympathetic to the special interest concerns. Number two, I think, and this is a more powerful reason, I think that having some of the people who have recognized and have fought against special interest clout, I think you have better chance if you have people who've been around there longer. If some people say, well, yeah, they become crooked after 10 years or 20 years or something, I think there's a lot of merit and a lot more turnover. I think the biggest thing we ought to be doing and the most important thing is addressing the special interest money aspect. I think that is far more important than addressing the terms, and I do have some objections to term limits in terms of how I think it does, it gives bureaucrats more clout, it gives lobbyists more clout, and I think in some cases it may make elections less competitive. If we made U.S. Congress terms 10 years, and I shouldn't use them, they're not competitive at all in many cases. If we made our state legislative terms 10 or 12 years, the maximum, after I've